I have no financial relationships, unfortunately, to disclose. Okay. While this is loading up, the first thing I'd like to do is thank the organizers, because I know it was very competitive this year to get an abstract and then to get one that was a presentation with like a major coup. So I'd like to thank them for selecting us. Secondly, I would like to thank my collaborators, Ms. Rachel Fisher, who is here, Dr. Olivia Thompson, Ms. Danita Bird-Holt, and Dr. Amy Lazarus-Yarrow. So today, my talk will consist of this brief outline where we will talk about the rationale of the study. I'm going to review some current statistics of both hunger and obesity, do sort of a quick run through of the literature, describe the study that we did, and also look at the public health implications and make some recommendations that are not of NIH, but they are my personal recommendations. Let me be clear about that. So when I started to think about the issue of hunger and obesity, the first thing that came to mind was Robert Wood Johnson had this ambitious goal, which we're still hopeful, of reversing the epidemic of childhood obesity by 2015. Well, within the same time frame, the president has decided to end childhood hunger. So you think about these two things at the end of both ends of the spectrum and how we're going to accomplish these goals. If you have read any of the literature at all around hunger and obesity, it'll be murky at best. And so, of course, that attracted me. I wanted to do more to make it murkier, to try to see what the problems were. The other thing that attracted me to this study was the opportunity to use the ECHOLS data set, which is the Early Childhood Longitudinal Survey, because it allowed for longitudinal review as well as cross-sectional review. In addition, there were direct assessments that were involved. So these children were measured. There were surveys that were done with the parents, the teachers, the principals. So it's just a wonderful data set, and I've never used it before, so I wanted the opportunity to do that. I also wanted to finally explore the role of food assistance program participation and how that relates to obesity. So I'm sure you've all seen this, and you will notice that between 1980 and 1988, we had a drastic jump in childhood obesity. And some experts say we are actually leveling off. I think not so much. If you look at the children between 6 to 11, we're up to almost 20% of those children being obese. And this is according to the NHANES survey. So this is not self-reported data. This is measurement data. Whether we've leveled off or not is not really an issue, because the number is still way too high. So as I said, there seems to be a leveling, at least with adults. The other fact about race, about obesity that is important, is race and ethnicity seems to play a major role. We noticed that the Hispanic boys and African American girls seem to be bearing the brunt of this epidemic. The other thing is the poor. Economics really matters. We know that there's a relationship. We don't quite understand what's driving it, but we know that there's a relationship and that exists even in the face of SNAP participation or some of the other food assistance programs. And of course, this question about whether it coexists with food insecurity. So to make sure the playing field is level, this is the definition of food insecurity that comes from the Life Sciences Research Office, and that is having limited or uncertain availability of nutritionally adequate and safe food, or limited uncertain ability to acquire acceptable food in socially acceptable ways. And I want you to think about the socially acceptable ways piece of this definition. So how does it work? Well, there is a USDA 18-module survey that assesses how people deal with lack of food in their environment. So it doesn't just measure food insufficiency, which has more to do with whether or not there was enough food, but actually the agony of being without food. So you have these four levels. You have the high food security, where there were no problems at all in accessing food. Marginal food security, where you have anxiety about not having enough food. Low food security, where you have reduced quality or variety. And then very low, where sometimes you have to go without food because of lack of money and other resources. So now let's turn to the facts about food insecurity. As of 2008, almost 15% of U.S. households were food insecure. 21% of those households that had children were food insecure. So we've got children living in these homes with not enough food. The other thing that is stark about 2008 statistics is, for the first time, they really state that increasing numbers of children are experiencing hunger directly. Usually the parents are able to shield the children against it, but with the economic downturn, we're seeing more children directly affected. Household composition is an issue. Single female-headed households tend to have more hunger. Race and ethnicity matters. African Americans and Hispanics have hunger at twice the rate of white children. Income matters. 34% of the low-income households were food insecure. Now, of that 34%, 57.8% of low-income children lived in these homes. Now, what is more stark is that 55% of the low-income households with food insecurity received assistance from one of the three federal programs, which means about 45% are not being served. So, what do we know about the literature? Well, it's all over the place. Inconsistent patterns have been observed. A study by Casey et al. Found that white girls with low socioeconomic status, there was a positive association such that the increase in food insecurity also led to increase in obesity. Now, what's interesting about the Casey study was that a few years back, he used the term food insufficiency and found no relationship. So think about that as we think about some of the recommendations for how we need to address this issue and look at it more systematically. In that same study, they found that African American girls with low socioeconomic status had a negative association. So girls of higher socioeconomic status were more likely to be obese than girls of lower socioeconomic status. Mexican American children, they seem to be nothing real consistent about it. There was a study by Kaiser et al. That found that there was no association at all. Another study by Matheson found that there was some association. And then there's yet another study that was conducted that found that there was a relationship with regards, it was sort of modified by the maternal stress factors. We know that age seems to bear out in most of the studies, so that older children are not spared as much as younger children. And food stamp participation, which is taboo, people don't like to think about it because we love food stamps and we know people need them, but there seems to be some association with that. And that relationship seems to also be modified by the level of hunger insecurity, meaning those who are less insecure are more likely to be obese. There is some evidence from a study done by Olson et al. That long-term food insecurity may also have an impact on your intake and your obesity level later in life. So we know that this is detrimental. And finally, there are all these things. It varies by the food security measure. I mentioned the thing that happened with Casey's study, where one time they used the USDA module and another time they used food insufficiency. And we've seen this as you go through the literature over time, we see the different terminology coming into play. We also see that acculturation plays a role. And as I mentioned, maternal stressors. So what were our research questions? And these were the two. Are children who live in food insecure households more likely to be obese than children in food secure households? And how does participation in SNAP modify this relationship? So as I mentioned, we used the early childhood longitudinal study, and that is a cohort study this particular wave, because there are three waves going on right now. The one from 1998 to 1999 is the one that we use. There's also a birth cohort that started in 2001 and another longitudinal cohort that will start started 2010. But it's about 21,000 children that are in this cohort. We particularly focused our sample on children who had measured BMI and also had food security information. These children were followed kindergarten, first grade, third grade, fifth grade, and eighth grade. Our study will look at the results of children in the first grade, the third grade, the fifth grade, and the eighth grade, because I wanted to have some distance between. And the questionnaires and direct assessments, of course, that I mentioned before, were a part of this study. And finally, what we did is we did a logistic regression to model obesity as identified by BMI Z scores. So the independent variables that we used were gender, race, ethnicity, mother's education, physical activity, food assistance participation, food security status, and age in months. And selected these based upon the literature and what we were finding in those. So we dumped all of those in a model, and we also looked at each one of those independent variables separately to see what happens. So here's our sample, and I want to first point out that you will notice that we started out with 15,000 kids. By the time we get to third grade, it's 8,570. And I was scratching my head about this. I was looking it up again last night just to make sure I had a clear understanding. But a lot of these children moved, especially those who were low income. So there was a lot of movement. Now, they followed a subset of those children, but they did not follow all the children who moved, especially if they were in a school that was not involved in this study. So of the sample, you'll notice that it was pretty evenly split with males and females. It was largely non-Hispanic whites. The next minority group that was large was Hispanics, followed by non-Hispanic blacks. I want to draw your attention to what happened with normal weight. If you look at the first wave, which is the first kindergarten group, you'll notice that 72, or almost 73% of the children were normal weight. But if you notice what happens in eighth grade, that drops down to about 62%. Same time, look at what happens with obesity. Obesity goes from 12% to almost 20%. So those kids are definitely shifting. The other part of that is for this particular group, the numbers for food insecure is about 14%. So there wasn't as much food insecurity in this population as we thought. And of course, you see what happens with SNAP and poverty threshold. So here's what we found. And let me sort of walk you through how I've done this table. So the dark bolded numbers are the odds ratio of the entire model. The ones in blue are the ones for where the individual variables were significant, but they fell out once the whole model was looked at. Okay. So you will see that, and there's one other thing. Because I was trying to get to the longitudinal piece, you'll notice I have kindergarten, third grade, fifth grade, eighth grade. To get to that longitudinal piece, we looked at indicators for children in the fifth grade as opposed to their weight in eighth grade to see if there was any relationship over time. So what you'll see is that male children, something about being male predisposed you to obesity in this particular study. It seems to go away a little bit in the eighth grade. You'll notice that, as I said, race and ethnicity matters, but it seems to be much stronger for Hispanic children, not quite as strong for African American children. It is also related to exercise, such that those who exercise less were more likely to be obese, no surprise there. We opted for mother's education versus mother's employment based upon the fact that we know a lot of mothers may stay home. And so therefore, that is not a true indicator of their ability to make decisions around food. So you will see that the less education a mother has, the more likely the child is to be obese. And I forgot to mention that the reference group for this study were white females who exercised 6 to 7 days per week, who lived above the poverty threshold, who were food secure, and their mothers were college educated, and they did not need food stamps. So poverty is an interesting thing. Poverty, once it was looked at alone, seemed to have a relationship, but when it was dumped into the model, that relationship seemed to disappear. Now, when you look at a lot of the studies that show that relationship between poverty and obesity, they're looking at poverty in and of itself. Dr. Yarrow and I and a couple of other colleagues actually have a paper that's coming out that are actually sort of try to explain this in a conceptual model that poverty is operating within its own sphere and not necessarily through food insecurity. So you guys stay tuned for that. That's my commercial. Okay, as far as SNAP participation, the same thing. We saw what looked like might be a relationship from longitude, from being on food stamps for a long period of time, or at least this is what I'm thinking. And this has actually been borne out in the literature. So the longer you're on food stamps, the more likely you are to be obese. And household food security, I mean, there it is, clear as day. We found it in eighth grade. We found it for children who were in fifth grade and then became obese in eighth grade. It was definitely a relationship there. When we looked at food insecurity by itself, we also found it with children in fifth grade. And actually, this third grade should be blue as well because we found it as an independent predictor. So in conclusion, we did not clear up any of the water. If anything, we made it even murkier. We have found an association with food security and obesity with caveats, and those caveats seem to be mother's education as a driver. It also seems to make a difference with regards to how much activity and all of these other things. So we're not sure exactly what's going on. Even though we didn't find a strong relationship between SNAP participation and food insecurity, we did see some trending that makes me think we need to look at that a little bit better. As far as the strengths of the study, it was a longitudinal study. It was a nationally representative. There were a whole lot of kids in this study. The limitations, of course, are the number of kids that dropped out. So it makes our examples not as robust. The other limitation that is concerning about this study is there were a lot of people who did not answer the food security question. So we had to put in a missing variable to account for that. We're hoping that has some way given us a little bit more strength, but at the same time, we have to, you know, have to come forward and let you know that. As far as future research, when I started to look through all of the studies, because I pored over them, and it's not that many, but it's probably 20, which is a lot since they started in 2001. They're all over the place. People define food insecurity different. In our particular study, we looked at the lower two levels and collapsed them to make food insecurity. Some of the other studies only used those who were very low food insecurity. Some of them didn't even describe how they did that. The other issue is how they collapse BMI. As you know, we now have BMI of greater than or equal to 95th percentile as obese, and that was different back when some of this work was done. We've just got to figure out how to ask the same questions to get the same answers, because when you look at them across the studies, they were done vastly different. So I bring back this definition. It is my hope to leave you with the idea that it is not socially acceptable for people to get food from food banks and pantries. We need to figure this out. And especially in light of what is happening with obesity, we cannot forget the people who are food insecure. So thank you for your time, and I'll address any questions. Yes.
Mm-hmm. That pretty much everything stayed the same except obesity.
Right.
And so you had a very interesting dropout, even dropout between races, between educate or whatever else. But can you think of any reason why the non-obese people, kids would have dropped out?
I have no idea. I did look back, and there are some differences. There were some differences in the education level of the parents. There were some differences in the schools, the resources of the school. And the other thing that they said was that the principals did not fill out questionnaires. So they could, if the principal didn't do his part, those kids weren't counted. So some of it is just an anomaly of how it was done. But there were some consistent differences over time. Yes?
Can I do a little quick add, which is that those of you who are interested in the topic,
thank you, Amy. Okay. Yes.
I know that this was a part of your study, but what do you think the implications are for SNAP recipients and obesity?
Well, I think, and I've thought about this because, as I said at the forefront, I really believe SNAP is important, and I think, you know, with my other hat, working in the community in hunger, people need these resources more than ever. But I do think it brings into question possibly, you know, what people are purchasing with their benefits. And I am not for, let me go on record, I am not for determining that. But I think it does say something about it. It does say something about stress, possibly. You know, maybe my model didn't pick up everything. You know, it could be that these people, I can imagine being extremely stressed when you can't feed your families. And you know, with maybe that does something with the stress hormones and how we put down fat. I mean, I think that there may be some physiological things that are occurring as well. So the bottom line is we definitely need to do more research, and we have to be more systematic in how we do it, because otherwise nobody's taking it seriously. Right. Yeah. And that's why I am saying, is something else going on? I met with my mentor yesterday, and I was telling her about this, and one of the things that she said is, she said, you know, we really need to deal with people's coping mechanisms and addiction and those kinds of things. Clearly something's missing out of this model, but we keep going around the same circle just to get some consistency in the variables that we have there, because we're not measuring them the same. Yeah, depression would be great. And this data set has that. Absolutely. Yes.
A couple of comments. The food sufficiency question that you mentioned earlier, it gets at a different concept than food security. When we developed the food security measures, mm-hmm. We did some analysis comparing those two, and we found that the food sufficiency question actually indicates a much more severe condition than it's more like the very severe, very low food security.
Right.
So
that's why I don't think they said. Right. That's what I think.
They're actually consistent with the.
Right. Right.
And also, when we were developing those measures, initially we had the acquired through acceptable means as part of the of the scale, but that scale was developed as a multi-objective government. So the food security scale doesn't actually measure that at all.
I know.
And you can, and it's very common to find food insecure people who do and do not receive emergency food assistance.
Right. And I think that's one of the research gaps. I mean, I think that we've got to figure out not only a research gap, but a policy gap. Figure out how to align what we do with the definition. Because I'm telling you, I live in Montgomery County, which is a very rich county in Maryland, and the numbers of people that we see coming through our food pantry is astronomical. We probably feed, 1,500 people a month, which is a lot of people when you think of the average income being over $100,000 a year. So, and your name, sir, I'm very honored to have you here.
I'm John Cook.
Nice to meet you. Okay, I think my time's up. Thank you very much.